Thank you very much, Adrian. Actually, the old Seneca got sold earlier in the year to somebody from WA, as it turns out. But thank you for the introduction. Thank you to AICC for putting on this event and for EY for hosting us in such a splendid venue. I think the reason you should turn your chairs around is to look at the view, actually, rather than at me. The title that we gave, Economic Conditions and Prospects, that's my standard boring title when I haven't thought of what I want to say. And that's usually the case up until a few days ago. But the title actually is After the Boom. And you'll get why there's that title soon. But it's very good to be back in Perth. As you know, we held our meeting here yesterday. We had to start a little early in order to meet the 2:30 Eastern summertime deadline for the announcement to come out. But we got through the meeting and decided to leave the cash rate at 2%. The reasoning behind that was given with the decision. So if you're having trouble sleeping tonight, I refer you to that statement. That'll help you get off to sleep. What I'd like to do right now, actually, is reflect on some of the adjustments going on in the economy in which Western Australia is very important, and hence the title, After the Boom. It's 4 years, actually, since the Reserve Bank last met here in Perth, September of 2011, and I don't need to tell you that a lot has happened in the intervening period. In September of 2011, the price of a tonne of iron ore was $170 US a tonne. A tonne of hard coking coal was bringing in $300 US. These were among the prices that saw Australia's terms of trade soar to a level 75% higher than their average for the preceding century. Well, few countries have seen a windfall like that in history. These extraordinary prices had already, by 4 years ago, triggered a massive investment build-up in the resources sector, which was lifting capacity. 4 years ago, Australia was shipping 1 million tonnes of iron ore a day. That was double what was being shipped only as recently as 2004. We were shipping a bit under 1 million tonnes of coal a day. By 2011, capital spending in the resources sector had already trebled since 2005. So that's where we were 4 years ago. That investment would rise a further 50% and then peak. Pardon me. The results of that investment have come on stream or soon will. Today, Australia ships 2 million tonnes of iron ore a day and about 1 million tonnes of coal. The investment was not just, of course, in iron ore and coal, on forecasts of strong demand from Asia, not just China, actually, but Korea and Japan as well. Massive investments are underway in gas. LNG exports have begun from some of the Queensland projects. They're going to ramp up further over the years ahead, and, of course, there are some very large projects in your state, which will come on stream over the years ahead. As they do, Australia's production capacity for LNG, which was 10 million tonnes a year a decade ago, will be 80 million at the end of the investment build-up. I'd like to note in passing that I think we, sitting over in Sydney, have been given a pretty good steer on the magnitude, the sheer size and the longevity of this build-up in capital spending on the back of the very good work done by our regional liaison people here in Perth. And they've been helped by many of you in the industry who give us your time and insight. And as a result of that, believe it or not, we've been a lot better at forecasting resource sector investment than we have been at forecasting investment in the rest of the economy. And that's because of the help you've given us. So thank you for doing that, and please keep doing that. It's extremely valuable. Well, as it happens, 4 years ago when we last had a board meeting here, that was about the peak for resource prices and Australia's terms of trade. What a peak it was. On a 10-year moving average basis, our terms of trade exceeded anything seen for 100 years. The reason it's worth doing it on a 10-year basis is that usually terms of trade spikes are very temporary. Think of the wool price boom in the Korean War era, just a year or two, and then gone. This boom elevated the 10-year moving average of the terms of trade way up compared to anything we've seen in the past century. So it was quite persistent. Not permanent, necessarily, and that's important, but quite persistent. Nonetheless, the peak was 4 years ago, and as you know, prices have fallen considerably. Today, iron ore is $40 a tonne, coking coal, $75. At a national level, our terms of trade, having been through an extraordinary surge, have fallen by about a third, and they're probably still declining at the moment. But even at those reduced prices, iron ore is still bringing a price 60% higher than it was in 2000. Natural gas prices, 50% higher than 2000. Terms of trade, well down from the peak, but still 30% higher than the very long-run average. They might fall further yet, time will tell. But in the meantime, many resource companies are making significant strides in reducing production costs so as to remain viable or indeed profitable, handsomely so in some cases, even at reduced prices. And that's consistent with the long-run story and experience in the resource industry. It's worth noting, I think, that Australia's presence in these commodities is greater now. It would be true to say that although weaker demand is part of the story recently for lower prices, a big part is also more supply, and a lot of that supply is from this continent and from the state where you live. The super cycle in commodity prices and the associated surge in capital spending have been of national and indeed international significance. At times, the price of iron ore has even, on occasion, displaced from page one of the newspapers that other price on which Australians typically focus so intensely, namely the price of a house. The spillovers of these activities have been felt around the country. For the 50 years up to 2005, resource sector investment was typically about 1.5% of national GDP. In a boom, it was 3%. In this boom, the peak was 8%, so nearly three times the normal peak, and easily the biggest surge for 100 years. The resources sector was doing 40% of the nation's total business capital spending, and a lot, as you know, a lot of that was being done here in WA. Well, on other occasions, these sorts of events have ended up being very disruptive for the national economy. Terms of trade surges in the 1950s or the 1970s produced, in the first phase, significant inflation on the way up, and then they were followed by a very major slowdown or a recession in economic activity as the terms of trade turned down. That hasn't happened on this occasion at a national level. Inflation was well contained on the way up. And while aggregate growth has been a bit disappointing for a couple of years now on the way down, still we're growing, not contracting. And in the circumstances we face, including very difficult global conditions in the aftermath of the financial crisis, I think the outcomes are quite respectable. In fact, in a number of respects, the economy has adjusted to the terms of trade shocks in the way you would hope. Productive resources were redeployed. Capital returns in resources were higher, so capital shifted to that sector. That also happened for labour. Relative wages in this state went up. People flowed. Much of that was from offshore, to be true, and not quite so much internal immigration, but there was some, and we had at the margin fly in and fly out and so on. So those were all helpful parts of the adjustment process. Likewise, the exchange rate did what it's supposed to do, in a flexible exchange rate system. It went up when things were very, very strong. Indeed, 4 years ago when we held our meeting here, the Australian dollar was buying $1.07 US, having been as high as about $1.10. Today it's 35% lower than that against the dollar and about 20% lower against the relevant basket of currencies. That movement, both up and down, was part of what helped the economy through the commodity super cycle without either seriously inflating on the one hand or crashing on the other. Through all that, tested macroeconomic policy frameworks have aimed at overall stability, and the financial sector has been kept in good shape by sensible regulation and generally competent management in the private institutions. While the episode isn't over yet, at this point, the economy overall has been recording growth, and we're about in the next 60 seconds to get the September quarter GDP number, so I won't predict that at this late stage, but looking ahead, the outlook appears to be it's 0.9. 2.5 through the year, so just a little below trend, but not that far below, as it turns out. That's not a bad outcome. Looking ahead, nationally, the outlook appears to be for a continuation of moderate growth. We issued our forecast just a few weeks ago, and so I won't go into detail here, but in brief, year-end GDP growth is forecast to be in the range of 2 to 3%, which is about where it is now, out to June 2016, and to pick up a bit after that. Domestic inflation is expected to remain relatively subdued, within the range of 1.5 to 2.5 over the coming year, 2 to 3%, consistent with our target beyond that. Unemployment around 6% or a little over for a while before gradually starting to come down. Well, that's the national picture. We don't make detailed forecasts at the state level, but obviously the picture for WA relative to the rest of the country has changed, as you would well know. Previously, economic activity here was exceptionally strong, leading the country, as was also the case in Queensland. On the other hand, in the southeast, things were rather subdued. Well, now that's swapped around. As the mining investment boom here is in reversal, and that was always going to happen, economic activity here is more subdued, while in the southeast, things are picking up. And you can see those differences in the data. Business investment in New South Wales and Victoria is growing, relatively slowly, but it is growing. In WA, of course, it's contracting very rapidly. I think most people have understood for some time that that was on the cards. Consumer spending and employment growth here in WA, which had outpaced the national average by a wide margin, previously has now come back to the pack. It's in fact a little below the national average. The rate of population growth, which was very rapid here, has slowed down. Housing prices have declined a little, whereas in Sydney and Melbourne, at least until recently, as you know, they'd risen at quite a clip. Business conditions here and in surveys are about their long-run average now. That's what businesses say, having been a long way above that average for some years. Excuse me. So WA has come back to the pack, so to speak, though the pack has actually picked up some speed in the meantime. But even with that, employment here is still increasing. The number of jobs here is still going up. The unemployment rate, to be sure, has increased a little, but only to about the national average, at least so far. You know, going back a few years, Western Australia had the lowest unemployment rate recorded of any state at any time in the past 40 years. On some occasions, there was a 2 before the decimal point. Well, that was probably not going to be sustained indefinitely, and indeed it hasn't been. But even though labour market performance is not as strong as it was, it's still nothing like as weak as in serious episodes like 1983 or 1991. Interestingly, those periods of serious weakness in WA's labour market were part of a national event. That national event was an asset price boom and bust, high corporate leverage, too much bank lending and so on. Had very little to do with mining, actually. Well, of course, further adjustment in the resources sector is ahead. Most of the construction employment losses in the iron ore sector have probably occurred, but the large LNG projects are still increasing headcounts, if anything. Over the next few years, presumably, there'll be some losses of jobs as labour is released from those projects. So it'll be a few years yet before one can have a conversation about the difficult phase being behind us. But the point I want to offer you is, nonetheless, there's a very positive legacy for your state as a result of the boom. Let me tell you why. Firstly, the sheer scale of the investment that's been undertaken makes Western Australian production, which has already was a powerful force in key commodities, even more powerful. To be sure, prices are lower than they were, but the quality of the resources, the attention given to cost reduction that's very intense now, and of course a lower Australian dollar are likely to leave many producers well placed. For the ordinary person, it's noteworthy that in the year 2000, Western Australia's per capita income was about the same as in Queensland or South Australia, and clearly lower than in New South Wales or Victoria. But in the interim, WA has seen easily the largest increase, and today, Western Australians enjoy the highest per capita income of any state in Australia at about 50,000 per head per year. It's true that if you look at the ACT or the Northern Territory, their per capita incomes are higher, but they're very unusual, they're very small, dominated by government employment subsidies and so on. So I think the relevant comparison is in sizeable states, and clearly Western Australia is well in front. It would actually take quite a few years, I think, at current rates of growth, for the other states to catch up to WA's income levels, even if you didn't move from here on in. Household net worth in Western Australia in 2014, and that's the latest figures we have, at about $950,000 per household, was considerably higher than elsewhere in the country. Since then, housing prices here have declined a little. They've gone up in New South Wales, so the gap has probably diminished, maybe closed. Even so, my guess would be that Western Australians, as well as having the highest per capita income in the country, are amongst the richest citizens in Australia as measured by net worth. So even if the other states gradually close that gap, as they might, you are still better off from having had the boom that you've had. Western Australia has unique endowments of resources. Mining has always been a cyclical business. You've always understood that. On this occasion, given the size of this boom, a massive event, biggest for 100 years at least, I think you and we collectively have done a pretty reasonable job of managing it. And as a result, there will be permanently more income and more wealth than there would otherwise have been. I expect that in a few years' time, the Reserve Bank Board will again come to Perth. I'll be long gone by the time that happens. But the board will come back here in some years' time. I imagine that by then the current contraction in capital spending will probably have reached an end. New opportunities for growth will have emerged, resulting from, among other things, the growth of the middle class in Asia, with all that means for demand for services or agricultural production as well as for energy. The growth of India is surely also a potential opportunity for WA. You sit on the Indian Ocean. And at a mere 8 hours flying time, you're much closer to India than those of us in the east. So no doubt, Western Australians will be looking to seize those opportunities, and not to mention the others that we've been hearing about in the material earlier today. At the same time, it'll still be the case that this vast part of the Australian continent, endowed by nature with so many natural resources, will be a major player in key commodities. Even if the extraordinary boom in investment was hard to digest, and even if it turned out that some of the investments don't pay off quite as handsomely as was hoped, it still seems to me that Western Australians will be richer for having had the experience. With that, I thank you very much for your attention. Have a great day. Thank you.
Hi, Morag McKinnon from Reuters. So I think you can guess what I'm going to ask. You briefly made a comment on that Q3 GDP data that came out during your speech. I wonder if you could elaborate a little further what you think about that third quarter figure. It was slightly above market expectations. What might it mean for the outlook going forward from here, and also for interest rates? Thanks.
Well, I could guess that you might ask that. I think you might be able to guess my response. I know the number was 0.9, that's all I know. I guess when I get to the airport after this, by then there'll be some detailed briefing for me to read, but it's probably just a touch above the numbers that we had embodied in our published forecasts, which I think would be welcome. Let's not overplay the significance, but the economy's growing, and I think the outlook for continued moderate growth, you would still say that's the outlook based on this incremental bit of additional information, but really I can't do any more than that, and I have no further guidance to offer, chilling out or otherwise, on interest rates today. Thank you.
Thanks, Glenn. I think that response is clear. I have a question from a gentleman here on this table.
Thank you. Thank you. Gordon Flake from the Perth US Asia Centre at the University of Western Australia. There was a lot of news this week about the possible or likely inclusion of the Chinese renminbi as a global reserve currency. This despite, you know, earlier this year, several unilateral devaluations. I'm curious, from your perspective, are there any immediate implications of that for Australia?
Well, what's happened is that the IMF, as I understand it, is in the process of approving the inclusion of the renminbi in a thing called the SDR, Special Drawing Rights, which is essentially a unit of account that the IMF uses for some of its operations. You can't actually go and buy an SDR in the market. It's not an actual currency. It's a composite measure of several currencies, and I think it's sensible enough to include the RMB in that. The RMB already was a reserve currency, let's be clear. We hold a small portion of our foreign reserves in it, and we have done for a little while, and a number of other central banks do as well. I imagine that as time goes on, probably the RMB is going to become more important as a currency. China's a very large economy. As they continue to liberalise their financial system and their capital account, use of the RMB will grow, I would expect. I think the IMF decision is kind of in the groove in that broader scheme of things. I don't think it has any particular ramifications for market prices or capital flows in the near term. That's my own view. Time will tell whether that's correct, of course.
Thank you.
Juana Lord, Lord & Company patent and trademark attorneys here in West Perth. Since 1979, we did experience the boom of the economy during the mining, as everybody else. And we'd like to know now, when do you think, your personal opinion, the next boom will be? And will it be a mining or innovation? And us turning our intellectual property and so on to work and produce maybe manufacturing special ones from WA and maybe all Australia.
I don't know when the next mining boom will be. I would note that the boom that you've just had, I don't think was very well predicted ahead of time. Certainly its magnitude and longevity, I think, was underestimated for quite a while. As for a boom in innovation, well, one hopes that that will occur. I think there are many issues to do with how Australia turns innovations which arise in the research dimension into commercialised innovations that are successful in business. That's not my field, so I can't really advise on how to strengthen that, but it does seem that that is one of the issues that we face. And I really can't do any better than the material that was displayed on the audio-visual earlier, which I'm sure in common with all of you, I found very interesting and quite exciting. But I can't really do better than that on whether and when there'll be an innovation boom. And as for mining booms in the future, there'll probably be some. But the timing of that is impossible to say.
Thank you. I'm sure there are a number of different views on when that boom might be. Table 12, I think. Back there. Yes, that gentleman, thank you.
Thank you. Governor Stevens, I just wonder if you're surprised that there is no deflation after such an unprecedented boom, and in the event there was, rather than relying on monetary policy, must be getting to the end of its tether. Have you got any other policy that you would implement if we do go through a deflation period?
Well, am I surprised that we're not having a crash in deflation? No, because it's been our intent to avoid that, and I think the first thing you do to avoid it is you try to minimise the excesses on the way up, which, by and large, I think we managed to do. That should put you in better shape to avoid the corresponding excesses in the other direction. So I remain, as I've said, of the view that we'll come through this okay. It is true that interest rates are already very low, as low as any of us here have ever seen in our life. But if needed, there is more that could be done on that front. Nonetheless, I think it is apparent globally that too much reliance is being placed on monetary policy. This is not an Australian comment specifically, it's a global one. There is too much reliance on central banks to lift countries into growth when monetary policy clearly has certainly reached the end of conventional capability in all these other countries with zero interest rates. And we need, I think, more focus on other policies which might be effective in lifting growth. And this was the main idea that we put in our host year of the G20 in 2014. The G20 additional growth objective, which Joe Hockey put onto the global agenda and which remains there, and which was a hallmark of Australia's presidency, that's about lifting growth everywhere in the world and none of the measures in the list of 100 plus measures that were enumerated were about monetary policy. They were about other policies. So the point there is that we shouldn't just rely on monetary policy alone in any country to drive growth. Other policies actually are ultimately going to be more effective. And that's a very important point.
Hi, Governor Stevens. Gary Hull from Cisco. A couple of things. You had an article in the IFAR the other day about investment in innovation and cybersecurity areas like that. And we saw this morning the role Israel played in the government in kickstarting their startup nation. And we have a government here in the state who can afford a facility out there but can't build a new building for SciTech. My sense is we're in an opportunity where we've come out of the boom for governments to invest and align in whatever this thing we're going to be good at in Australia for the future. What's your sense of the role in governments in that and how that's going to play out around innovation in particular?
Well, I don't want to buy into whether the government of Western Australia should invest here or in some other thing, obviously. I'll duck that. But I think... I suppose I'd say that the role of public policy, you can think of there being a spectrum of things that can be done. A lot of it is enabling, which I suppose goes to education, R&D, funding or concessionality. So there's enabling. There's, are we sure that we're not getting in the way of innovation and investment in innovation that might otherwise take place? There are a set of questions that the governments would, you know, contemplate there. And I don't think one, I anyway, would not rule out on principle governments taking a funding position, almost an equity stake, if you like, provided that it's done properly. In a way, I suppose I'd... Perhaps there's a slight parallel with government involvement in infrastructure. We feel we're short of infrastructure. The problem isn't finding the money. The problem is... The problems to be solved are the governance ones around which project... I suspect that might well be true in the innovation space as well. It's not for me to say whether it would be sensible or appropriate for a state or a federal government to directly invest. I don't see why you would rule that out of court at the beginning. You'd consider it. But I suspect the funding is probably the smallest of the problems. I suspect there are other more tricky issues to solve than that. Not insoluble, but to be solved nonetheless.
Thanks. Table 14 here.
Thank you, Mr. Stevens. Jonathan Barrett at the Financial Review. You've previously expressed concern about Sydney property prices. Has that concern been alleviated? And if so, has it come at the expense of weaker markets like Perth, which are also subject to the, I guess, more strict policy and lending criteria?
I think the measures that APRA took were well calibrated. They're having an appropriate effect. And I'm not... I don't really see much evidence that it's materially affected Perth or other markets in an adverse way. I'm not aware of that, any evidence to that effect. And I have no further comments on Sydney or other property prices beyond what was in yesterday's statement.
Thanks. Totally.
Camillo Della Maddalena, CDM Australia. Despite the expectations of the non-mining industry, having increased in investment, that hasn't materialised. And the government bringing mechanisms in to curtail the housing industry, at what levels below the current benchmark would you expect it to become a compelling matter for the board to review interest rates to come down?
Well, I'm not going to speculate on future board decisions. We've given our view yesterday, and there's no additional guidance, so to speak, that I'd want to offer. I would offer, though, the observation that I don't actually think that non-mining business investment or any form of business investment, in fact, is particularly responsive to interest rates per se. There's no evidence really that it is or has been in the past. I think if and when that pickup in capital spending outside of mining occurs, it will be because businesses in those sectors feel more confident in their future sales and the general state of the economy. It won't be because of some tweak to the cost or availability of credit. The credit's available at low cost if they want it. And actually business borrowing's picking up according to the credit data. But I think it's the broader economic picture that determines the decisions that businesses make about CapEx spending.
For a couple more quick questions. We haven't yet had the exchange rate prediction question that I was anticipating. Anybody game enough to see if try the arm at asking the governor's view as to where he and the board think that the exchange rate might settle over the next 12 months or so?
Why would you think such a forecast is of any value?
Well, I think there might be a number of people in the room who think that information might be of value to them, actually, for those who are selling things in US dollars.
Well, so we need it lower for those people and higher for those going on holidays. There's a fundamental insight there. The exchange rate, it's a relative price. So
get the internet shoppers for the moment and look at the exporters. Yes, two hands going up there. I'll take the one behind first, if I could. Patrick.
Thank you, Glenn. Patrick Canyon's my name, from IPAC Western Australia. I'm wondering, in 2015, how relevant is the target inflation range of 2 to 3%? How relevant is that in today's market for the Reserve Bank in determining their policy?
It's still relevant. I said in a speech last week that it's the case around the world at the moment that inflation rates being a little below target's a lot more common than being a bit above, and that it's perhaps not as easy as the textbook says it ought to be for central banks to push inflation up. That having been said, though, I think for us, well, our forecast is still that we will be consistent with the target over the next 2 or 3 years. And I think the inflation targeting framework, it's easily the best framework we've had in the past 50 plus years. There may be a better one, but nobody's come up with it yet. And until they do, I think this is the best framework that we have. It's been effective. It's still fairly effective, actually, at anchoring inflation expectations, which is important. It's still, I think, proving to be a very useful and important guide for policy setting. So it's still relevant. If there's a better framework, let's hear about it. But to date, this framework beats all the others we've tried, and we've tried quite a few over the long run. And so I think we stick with it until there's something better on offer.
One more question, I think, on table 7 here, please.
Good morning. Peter Saunders from Morgan Stanley. I'd be interested in your thoughts on the employment data. In the last 18 months, there's been a lot of volatility in the numbers and revisions, and we saw a particularly strong number against expectations in the last month. So how does the RBA interpret the employment data and the trend that is currently coming through?
Well, there have been some data issues, that's true. I don't want to get into the game of interpreting one month's figures. I think you should take a run of months together. Even before we received that latest one, the sequence was a pretty solid one. Employment was growing at 2% or more per year. The rate of unemployment at worst was steady. Ratio of employment to population going up. Participation going up from low levels, admittedly, but rising. That was consistent, actually, with rising job vacancies. We had the extra month's data. Well, all of that's still true, maybe even a bit more true, given the strength of the figure. I don't think it's possible to easily dismiss the monthly observation on your kind of sampling grounds, but it's 1 month. We should take it with the sequence of other months, and if you do that, it's actually a pretty strong sequence over the past year, and I think that's, it's really hard to avoid that conclusion, taking all the data together. So that would be my my take on the labour market data.
Thank you. I'm told by John that we have one last, a moment for one last question if anybody has anything. Yes, I'll take this lady here, Lynn.
Lynn Beasley, Murdoch University. Thank you for a fascinating talk and interesting insights. I'm going to go back to the question raised by my colleague at Cisco here and ask about the resources boom was very much driven by science, technology, engineering and maths, STEM as we now know it. Yet a quarter of our kids are giving up this in year 10 and not pursuing it, whereas our competitors overseas are accepting this challenge and moving forward. Do you think this is an important issue? And if so, how do you think we should address it, please?
Yes, I think it's a very important issue. And I don't know quite what to do about it because I do interest rates. And best I can tell, nothing we do with the interest rates has any effect on this particular problem or indeed many others. It is an issue. And, you know, I've read the stuff that Ian Chubb has said over the years. I find that persuasive. And so this is a question that I think we collectively as a society have to grapple with. But it's not within my knowledge, nor is it my responsibility or my prerogative, frankly, to kind of dictate or seek to advise on just how you do it. I don't have the answer to that question. I'm sorry. I'm sorry to end on such a don't know note, but that's the truth.
Okay, well, in that case, I'll take one more question. There was a lady on table 9, I think, who was itching to ask a question.
Thank you, Glenn. Sharon Fay from Clear Perceptions. I'm a corporate psychologist. You know, pick up on the. You might not guess what I'm going to ask. Because I just picked up that, you know, if the board had its last meeting in Western Australia 4 years ago, and if it's another 4 years and you'll be long gone, what does that say?
I'm not sure it says anything in particular. The fact that I'll be gone is just...
Are you going to be gone in 4 years?
I'm going to be gone in 9 months.
Oh.
The board, maybe I should just explain the, we meet mostly in Sydney, that's where the bank is, where all the resources, the staff resources are and so on. We meet once a year in Melbourne, and we meet once a year in another state capital, and we go around. Next year we'll be meeting in Hobart, actually, which we haven't done before. So on that schedule, we'll come back to, or the board, not including me, will come back to WA in a few years' time. And I think we find great value in moving around like that. It's quite a logistical effort to do things interstate, not least with the time zone change here. But the value is the opportunity to meet as a board the local business community, senior leaders and so on. And that's been very helpful over the past couple of days. So it's a very useful thing to do, which is why we will indeed come back. What the psychological import is of the four-year gap, I don't know.
Thanks very much. I think that is a slightly more positive note.